From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Before we get to the new Nick Cave movie coming out next week, and before we start talking about an unexpected global hit of the 1990s, let's dip into the mailbag again. Dylan from Northport, Long Island writes,
"Dear John, sometimes I find that if an artist has a particularly poor attitude, it cheapens and devalues the music for me. For example, I have a great distaste for Keith Jarrett's music. While he is a brilliant improviser and technician, the way he mistreats his audiences for coughing and/or sneezing during his performances, and then gyrates and loudly grunts during his solos, seems to strike me as not just hypocritical, but insincere. Do you find that an artist's terrible attitude is enough to negatively affect your perception of an otherwise enjoyable piece?"
Well, Dylan, for me, the answer is no. I love the music of Richard Wagner, you know, Ride of the Valkyries and all that, but the man himself was an anti-Semitic jerk. Hell, I like the music of the Renaissance composer Carlo Gesualdo, and he killed two people. So Keith Jarrett scolding an audience for making noise doesn't seem like such a deal breaker to me. And if I go to a Keith Jarrett concert, it's in part to see what kind of antics he'll perform on stage, along with or instead of music. Now, I happen to know that Bob Mould, the former frontman of the band Husker Du in the 80s and then the group Sugar in the 90s, is a nice guy, but that doesn't mean I have to like his music. I like it because, well, even when he doesn't have a band with him, when it's just him and his electric guitar, he still rocks. Bob Mould's latest album is called Beauty and Ruin, and Bob is here to play some of it for us live on Soundcheck today. This song is called The War.
Oh, and all these songs I write for you tear me up, it's not hard to do. Listen to my voice, it's the only weapon I get from the war. From the war. From the war. Yeah, yeah. From the war. And I can't soothe every hell you endure, and I can see into the future most assured. Yeah. I don't have a choice, it's the only life I know after the war. Up from the war, up from the war, yeah. From the everything we made reduced to dust. You are the one who taught me most. Carry your remains, implement your name, and nothing left will ever be the same now. But we kept on keeping on, ringing in my brain.
is what remains, is what remains, is what remains. This war has worn me down. Broken dreams and a hole in the ground. Don't give up and don't give in now.
That is Bob Mould live on Soundcheck with a song from his latest album, Beauty and Ruin. That song is called The War. Bob Mould singing, playing the electric guitar, slung low, almost down to your knees.
Always.
Doesn't that, you know, you've been doing this a long time. Doesn't that put a strain on your back?
On my left shoulder.
On your left shoulder.
I'm a little crooked all the time like that. So.
I mean, when you start playing guitar, they teach you to hold it kind of up high, you know, because it... Your balance better. You're like down, reaching down.
I know,
to hit
down,
the guitar.
Down low. Well, I was watching Johnny Ramone. You know,
yeah,
so that's probably
that,
where that came from.
That low slung look, absolutely.
Yep.
So the latest album's called Beauty and Ruin. But before we get to, you know, what you've been up to very recently, just, you know, in the past couple of weeks, videos have been emerging all over the place. The death of Joan Rivers has occasioned. All these people, like, posting your old band, Husker Du, on Joan Rivers. How did that happen?
Well, I think that was when she had just started the show on Fox. And Husker Du, at the time, that was my first band. It was 1987. We had just put out what would be our final album. It was our second album for Warner Brothers called Warehouse Songs and Stories. And as part of the, you know, as part of the promotional roundabout, you know, during the tour and... Somebody said, how would you feel about doing Joan Rivers? And this was, you know, Husker Du fresh off an appearance on the Today Show. So
you were making the rounds.
We were making the rounds at that time, and we thought, sure. And I remember showing up that day, and they had the entire stage done up like the album cover with the Dayglow twigs and columns. And,
oh, all right.
I mean, they really went out of their way on the show to make us comfortable. And, you know, I remember Joan coming in and... You know, we did the prep where she was like, I'm going to talk about this and talk about that. I want to get pronunciations of names right and all that. And she was very, very sweet, very, very gracious and nice to us. And it's one of the funnier moments on television.
Well, and let's, for folks who haven't seen it, let's at least give you a chance to hear a little bit of Bob Mould and the rest of Husker Du, April 27th, 1987, on The Late Show starring Joan Rivers.
But do you find yourself playing different kinds of music when you went from being radical to moving? How have you changed?
I think, you know, as you know, with anything you do, any kind of craft or any kind of art or, you know, anything, as you get older, you know, your emotional spectrum becomes a little more involved, a little wider, and it's not just screaming about how messed up the government is and how much you hate your parents anymore, you know.
It's singing into a better medley.
Yeah.
Now, give us each one, get your names. I want to know who's the calming one, who's the wild one. Who's in the group? Who's your, tell me.
My name is Bob Mould.
You're Bob.
And
all right.
I guess calming.
You're
would be
the calm one. All right.
One of, yeah.
Is that true? Were you always the calm one in the band?
Relatively. relative to everyone else in the band,
relative
perhaps.
To the rest of the band, yeah. How odd is it for you to hear... You, 25 years ago, talking about as you get older and your feelings mature.
And there's always that point in your life, I guess, you know, as an artist where you start to think, oh, I'm becoming an old soul. You know what I mean? After that, in 1989 with Workbook, definitely.
Your solo debut.
Yeah, sort of the autumnal album. Yeah, that definitely felt like, oh, no, I'm approaching the end. So, you know, here
and
we
you
are.
Would have been what, like?
28? So, you know, it's...
Don't you want to go back and just smack that kid?
No, I mean, there's a long... I think there's a long tradition in rock and roll of this where, you know, you get to that period where you start to start to really feel old, and then, you know, and then, you know, here I am at 53 going, hmm.
So if 28 was autumnal, what season are you in now?
Autumnal. It's a long autumn.
Have you? Okay, so you didn't go through like winter, spring. You haven't gone through like a whole bunch of cycles.
No. I don't think we get to go backwards. Like that.
So is there something that that's in the Bob mold of that first 1989 album that is still in this 2014 version?
Very little. I think, you know, if anything, as the last 3 years have seen me very, very busy with a lot of projects, a lot of reissues and such, when I'm not working, I'm equally as isolated in my personal life as I was when in 1988 when I was writing Workbook. You know, having said that, I'm sort of hard-pressed to remember the last time I was home for any period of time in the past few years. But when I'm home, I feel like that person again. I just sort of pull the blinds down and just go in the backyard and sit by myself and, you know, enjoy the quiet of not being in an airport or at a sound check or on whatever it is that we do.
Right. So that album Workbook is getting its 25th anniversary. Mm-hmm, yeah. So you've been doing a lot of looking back. I mean, the last time you were on Soundcheck was for the autobiography. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, your dad passed away, a major figure in your life story.
Yeah. In 2011, the autobiography came out. And, that was my first time, I think, in my life looking back at the stuff that I was doing and stuff I had done. And there's a lot of stories about my childhood in there and my dad, who is obviously an important figure in a lot of different ways. Mm-hmm. My dad passed in October of 2012, and it was about a month into the touring for Silver Age, which was a big, sort of a big celebration, big party, and this other event was running parallel to it that I was, keeping to myself and dealing with, as a son and part of a family. And when he passed in October, that was the beginning of the 12 months of writing for Beauty and Ruin.
Well, that's kind of where I was going with this is, when you are in a kind of place where you're doing a lot of looking back, father passes, autobiography, 25th anniversary of the first solo record. What does that do to the forward-looking process, which you have to be in when you're writing a new record?
I think it's okay to look back. I don't know if I enjoy the dwelling on the past. This year, for instance, when the Workbook reissues came out, I did a handful of shows going out and playing the material, and it was really nice, but it was so unlike, the material itself is so unlike where I'm at with Beauty and Ruin or Silver Age. This recent 3 years, looking back and then moving forward and being sort of punk rock about things again, the Workbook revisit was a little wacky. Just looking back, touching those songs again, I was like, wow, this is so not where I'm at right now. Yeah. So it was a little bit of a battle for me. But, I think spiritually it's been great. I have a whole different view on those things now, obviously. When you're in the thick of it, it's all a blur. It's all like a fist fight or like a dust storm. And then, years later, you see all the dust on the ground. And
interesting that you use the word spiritually in the same sentence that began with a reference to how you're feeling a little more punk again these days. Because, early on, you wouldn't have put those two together. But there was a spirit of punk.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the 80s, it was an amazing period for American music, I guess what we, where punk rock became hardcore, and different areas of the country had different impressions of what punk rock was. DC was very different from Chicago, was different from San Francisco and LA, but the common denominator is we were all fighting against a system, a very exclusive rock and roll, limos, private jets, arenas, groupies, drugs, guns, these things that really we didn't aspire to that as bands in the 80s. We just wanted our message to be heard. And so, yeah, that was, it's very spiritual. It's very much like preaching, very much going door to door, like the Latter-day Saints or something. Showing up, I have this single. Would you give me a dollar? I can turn that into gasoline to get to the next town.
Right. So and, you know, very much a communal kind of experience mm-hmm. and, you know, little clubs in the Twin Cities, you know, yeah. before moving on to the Joan Rivers show.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, I mean, that journey was interesting, that 8 yeah. years in Husker Du, starting out, you know, everything that we wanted to destroy was what we were slowly becoming.
Mm.
And there's always that conflict as an artist. You want to do well, but then you don't want to do too well. And
yeah. Yeah,
it's this constant thing.
Do you still have that, are you still afraid of a certain level of success?
I'm not built for that level of success. I've learned that about myself. I sort of like being, you know, a smaller, low-flying craft. I'm not sure I want to be the Learjet, you know. I've been on both, and it's I sort of like just being closer to the ground, I think.
We're speaking with Bob Mould. His latest album is called Beauty and Ruin. He's playing here. You're touring with a trio, but you're playing here mm-hmm. for us solo and,
yep.
and very much plugged in. You want to do I Don't Know You Anymore next?
Yeah, another one of those I Don't songs that I have about 50. I just went through my publishing list and I saw I have like 15 of those, I think. So.
All right. Variations on a theme from Bob Mould, Strapping on the Electric Guitar. We'll get another live performance here in the Soundcheck studio. The song is I Don't Know You Anymore.
Swept across a weathered floor, yeah. And no idea how to start solving puzzles from before. And maybe in time this confusion will fade. But every single error we made was right there from display. Well, I don't know you anymore. The name and face have been obscured. We'll change them if you want, but I don't know you anymore. Yeah. Gonna play back everything we said. All the words are out of place. And as the tape rewinds inside my head, shedding, but I can't be saved. Sing record when I wanted to play. Message is clear how you push me away. It's more than I can take. Oh, well, I don't know you anymore. The name and face have been obscured. We'll change them if you want, but I don't know you anymore. Yeah. Had a vision of one last try. What does it mean to me? Well, it's always a tear-stained face. Staring back so silently. Well, I heard a voice travel over the wine, telling the tales filled with riddles and rhymes that I don't recognize. Well, I don't know you anymore. The name and face have been obscured. We'll change them if you want, but I don't know you anymore. Yeah. Oh, well, I don't know you anymore. The name and face have been obscured. We'll change them if you want, but I don't know you anymore. Anymore, yeah.
Once again, Bob Mould live on Soundcheck. The album's called Beauty and Ruin. That song is I Don't Know You Anymore. And I mentioned at the top of the segment, Bob, that, you know, you've been popping up on video sites for a while now. One reason was the Joan Rivers show, the Husker Du thing that we heard before from so many years ago. But also there's the video for that song that has Colin Malloy from the Decembrists.
Yeah. So,
you know, kind of teaching you how to move product.
Yes.
In the modern age.
Yes, in the modern age. How to blorf. Yeah, for people who haven't seen it, it's really cute, really funny. Yeah, I sort of show up at this sort of questionable rehearsal space, and Colin's just in the neighborhood picking up swooping wax for his mustache.
For his mustache.
Yes, and kale-infused bacon, vegan donuts at 2 a.m.
And he looks so much like John Hodgman with the mustache now.
Wow. Yes. Colin's a great guy. We've known each other for a while, and we had filmed the video in Portland, so he was very generous with his time to come by and help. And yeah, we had a real nice script. We did a lot of improv inside of that, and it sets up this story of back in the day when people would line up in front of record stores to wait for albums, and now they line up in front of insert large corporation that just announced a new phone today.
Well, it's here. You're clearly riffing on Apple. You know?
Yeah, a little bit. We're riffing on. And I was worried they were going to come down on us, and then I would have, just said something like, well, it could have been Samsung.
Yeah, right. So. The video is on our website at soundcheck.org. Cool. It is definitely worth 3 minutes of your time. Actually, 4 minutes, because there's like the funny bit at the beginning, and then you actually get the song, the video, in which Colin Molloy of the Decemberists makes another cameo at the end. And then you yourself have a cameo in the new Ryan Adams video.
Yeah, that was that just sort of happened. The band and I were in Los Angeles a while ago, maybe last month, making a video for the song The War, the first song that I played. And I sort of had this moment where I was like, wouldn't it be nice at the end, after I'm sitting like this news anchor at the desk, sort of at that quiet ending, sort of feeling not defeated, but just ready to take a break. And I thought, we got to get somebody to get Ryan, get somebody, come in that. And so I can sort of pass these off and say, here, hold these for a moment while I go take a break. And it was really nice of Ryan to come over. So the next day, my band, we were shooting our live performance video. It was like 7 hours of, barely lip syncing. I mean, I was pretty hoarse. And then Ryan says, come over. We're making these commercials. I want you to come in. And so it was like midnight, and I'm exhausted. But
he's just appeared on yours.
Yeah,
quid
pro quo. And it was really nice of him to ask me to come over, and we had a hilarious time sort of wrecking his song a little bit.
Yeah, because the video does not it's not like a real kind of lip sync to the recording. Again, people just have to go online and see it.
Ryan's stuff is brilliant.
It's really bizarre and really strange. Now he's created. I mean, he's got his own studio there. And have you worked with him on that level?
We've done I've hung out a bunch of times. It's a really great place. It's a little studio called Pax Am. And Ryan has amassed an incredible collection of vintage gear, a lot of analog gear, compressors and limiters, and real high quality stuff. The vibe is great. It's very, very comfortable. Ryan's sort of like this amazing host when you walk in. Anything here? He's always making sure everybody's okay. And it's very sweet, and a lot of good work gets made there. Not only his work, but
He's produced a couple of records there recently.
Jenny Lewis.
Right.
Last time I was there, he was working with Butch Walker. I came in and did a little stuff and met Butch, and he was great. We've done various celebrities dropping by to jam at times, and stuff that I didn't know we were talking about, but there you go. But it's great. Ryan's a real wonderful guy, and it's been funny as I start posting things and sort of revealing our friendship on my social media. he's still sort of a polarizing figure to some, people who I think about him then, as opposed to people who sat down and worked with him last week. So there's a part of me that just wants to reach out and say, "Do you know this is my friend you're dissing?" And he's not at all what you think. But anyhow,
he's here tomorrow.
Well,
he'll be sitting in that seat and playing into that microphone tomorrow.
I'll leave him a note.
the thing is, he's got that Meniere's disease, and you have tinnitus.
I'm always ringing. It's always ringing.
Even now. So for you, is turning up the volume on the electric guitar a kind of therapy? Does that drown out the ringing in the ear?
When I'm on stage with the band and we're playing a show, I don't really feel anything. It's only afterwards. I mean, that 90 minutes where we go out and we do what we do and it's what people come to see,
right.
That's the price that you pay for it, I guess. And it's at the end of the night and it's in the morning and it's all that stuff, just the constant ringing all the time.
Yeah. So. All right.
Yeah.
The album is called Beauty and Ruin, and this final song is a fun number. It's called Hey, Mr. Gray.
Hey, Mr. Gray, that's what the children say. Life used to be so hard. Get off my yard. They're so young, they're so dumb, they don't understand. Kids don't follow, kids don't wait, kids go hand in hand. Hey, Mr. Blue, the broken-hearted fool. You wonder why the one you love would lie. Said, hey, Mr. Green, your grace is rarely seen. So filled with rage, and then you disengage. You get so up, get so down, get mixed up inside. Kiss up death, kiss up love, kiss it all goodbye.
Hey, Mr. Gray, a song from Bob Mould, live performance here on Soundcheck. Bob, a pleasure to see you again. Thank you
so
much.
Thank you for having me.
Australian singer-songwriter Nick Cave is at the heart of a new film called 20,000 Days on Earth. We'll talk with the directors about making a movie that's part truth, part fiction, and all centered around one imaginary day in the life of Nick Cave. That's next on Soundcheck.
The problem was, she had a little black book. And my name, it was written on every page.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. In the background, you're hearing a performance by the band Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. This is a scene from the new film 20,000 Days on Earth, which follows the 56-year-old Australian singer-songwriter on what seems to be a day in his life. A very busy day as he works in the studio on the album that would become the band's 2013 record, Push the Sky Away. He also digs through artifacts in his personal archive, drives around in his car, conversing with friends like singer Kylie Minogue. But this documentary film doesn't quite behave like a documentary. It's more of a personal manifesto and a very candid look inside Nick Cave's creative process. Joining us here to talk about it are the directors behind 20,000 Days on Earth, Ian Forsyth and Jane Pollard. Guys, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi. It's
hello,
good to be
thank
here.
You.
So, how did this film start? This wasn't the initial idea, was it?
No. It started with a really small idea, which was we were in the studio with Nick filming. And nobody had ever really filmed that band that early in their process. And the footage we were getting was just remarkable. It was something so much. It deserved not to just whimper out onto YouTube in some 10-minute making of clip. We knew we had to do something more with it, so we decided we needed a bigger boat, a vessel of some description, and a film, an ambitious film, seemed to be the way to do it. I mean, we started very much with that idea of how do you make a normal, ordinary documentary about an artist as extraordinary as Nick Cave? You have to have something bigger, different, more ambitious.
Well, and you also have to have the trust of that artist. Now, you guys, Ian, have you worked with Nick Cave a lot?
Yeah, we've known each other a few years now, so we've kind of, I think the film could only really be made with that friendship behind us. So we've worked together maybe 7 or 8 years now. We've done various things. We've made music promo videos with Nick, and we produced the soundtrack for The Death of Bunny Munro, his novel, the audiobook, and all sorts of things. And over that time, you know, you grow to know each other pretty well.
So you could, in fact, be a fly on the wall during those early studio sessions, as opposed to, you know, things always change when the observer prints, the observer effect,
yeah,
right?
For sure.
Jane, it seems like one of the great kind of gifts of this film is to watch Nick Cave and the band sort of working out the process, working out the songs. Early on in the movie, we get a chance to hear Nick Cave and the band sort of workshopping the song Higgs Boson Blues, which would come out on the album, Push the Sky Away. And then later in the film, where's this concert shot where we hear the same song live?
That's in a small show in London.
We did
a small show in London, yeah.
So you hear a little bit of the song in progress and then the finished product from the film called 20,000 Days on Earth.
I'll let the damn day break. Rainy days always make me sad. Miley Cyrus floats in a swimming pool in Toluca Lake.
Miley Cyrus floats in a swimming pool in Toluca Lake. You're the best girl I ever had.
Cave recorded live in London, and the song is called Higgs Boson Blues. We heard a little bit of Nick and the band sort of workshopping that in his studio in Brighton. Both of these clips are from the film 20,000 Days on Earth, which 20,000 days is how many years?
It's like 54 and a bit.
So ostensibly, this is how old Nick Cave is on the day in which all this action is taking place.
Yeah, that's the conceit.
That's the conceit.
I mean, the title, that phrase came from Nick directly. It was a phrase that was in his notebook, and we borrowed. Nick writes in longhand and, you know, writes an awful lot of material and then edits a lot to get to the record.
And also types on a typewriter, an old-fashioned typewriter with the black and red ribbon. And
I mean, I think for Nick, it's, you know, the process is really important. And I think once he's gone through a number of revisions in longhand, he likes to go to the typewriter and type up a revised final version of a lyric.
Right. And we see him in the studio, you know, kind of reading off of his typewritten sheets as he's working out the songs. Ian Forsyth, Jane Pollard are with me on Soundcheck, directors of the, let's call it a documentary. What do you guys call it?
We try not to. It's a film. You know.
Film called 20,000 Days on Earth, which won awards for Best Directing and Best Editing at this year's Sundance Film Festival. It opens here in New York on September 17th. Speaking of, you know, watching the process unfold, there's a really neat moment where Nick Cave talks about, you know, how early on in the process things like counterpoint become important and how that plays out. Listen to this.
Do you want to know how to write a song? songwriting is about counterpoint. Counterpoint is the key. Putting two disparate images beside each other and seeing which way the sparks fly. Like letting a small child in the same room as, I don't know, a Mongolian psychopath or something. And just sitting back and seeing what happens. Then you send in a clown, say, on a tricycle. And again, you wait and you watch. And if that doesn't do it, you shoot the clown.
Now, this just reminds me that throughout his career, Nick Cave has been dogged by the fact that he has this really dark, dry, deadpan sense of humor, which he has ascribed to being Australian. I think it's just because he's Nick Cave, personally. But what we just heard, that's there are moments of narration, clearly scripted narration by Nick, but then there's a lot of stuff that seems to be unscripted, where it's just kind of unfolding, you know, a psychotherapy session, a trip to his personal archives and stuff. So how much of this was planned and how much of this did you guys just kind of throw in front of him?
Well, the narration, the voiceovers that you hear, they were all written in advance, of course. Nick wrote those. Everything else is, broadly speaking, improvised. There was no dialogue script going into making the film. And one of the big principles we had as filmmakers was that we didn't want to treat Nick like an actor. So we never had a kind of cause to go, can we go back and do that again? Or look, could you just say that line slightly differently or slightly clearer? So consequently, we had to film an awful lot.
A lot of what we see is Nick in his car, you know, and people sort of appear in the car. And the way it's edited, at one moment they're there and the next minute he's in the car alone again. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's almost like he's hallucinating that these folks are in the car with him.
Yeah.
He's so important in my life. You were like this kind of mist that rolled in. Because I knew about you and had heard about your desire to do this song. And then I saw you perform live with the Bad Seeds and I was like, ugh. You're walking up this ramp to go on stage. It was like a scene from a film. You all just had this kind of swagger and the energy, you know, when you're building up to go on stage. And then the performance was just electrifying and your body language, you were like this, like a tree. That probably doesn't sound...
Like a big tree?
Like, you know, like from a Hitchcock film, a kind of tree in silhouette, like really... in a storm or something. It was amazing.
Because you didn't know much about what I did, right?
No, I had to speed read your biography.
Oh, you read that thing?
Yeah.
That wasn't the truth, so...
now, he did have a kind of a... It was a minor car accident in Brighton a few years ago, but, you know, it turned into like a big media thing because he is Nick Cave and the British media got hold of it. So he took out a speed camera there in Brighton. His twin sons were in the back seat, but everyone was fine.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, the image of him driving in a car, we heard it in the Higgs Boson Blues that we were listening to a moment ago. And there's a lot of Nick Cave in his car in this film called 20,000 Days on Earth. So, you know, he talks pretty openly about his childhood, growing up, his family, the first time he saw Susie, his wife. We don't hear anything about any of the women pre-Susie. So were there certain things that you guys knew were off-limits going into this?
Not at all, no. I mean, Nick really totally threw himself open to the process. But the thing for us that was really important was that we were making a film about Nick now, right here, right now. So there wasn't a kind of... I mean, if you remember the opening sequence of the film, you see a big, fast montage of a lot of library material, Nick, mm-hmm. over the years. I mean, for us, that was really about kind of clearing the slate, just going, look, that's 19,999 days of Nick's life. That's out of the way in the first minute of the film.
Right.
And now we wake up today and we're talking about Nick now.
At the age of 54 years and some odd days, whatever 20,000 adds up to. Now 56 years old, Nick Cave is the subject of the film 20,000 Days on Earth. With me in the soundcheck studio, the two directors of the film, Ian Forsythe and Jane Pollard. 20,000 Days on Earth opens here in New York on September 17th. Let me ask you about the psychotherapy session, because, you know, this really does go to a lot of the stuff that is in that opening montage. He goes back to, you know, his childhood in Australia and talking about his dad and his dad's death and stuff like that.
Did your father ever come to see you play?
He came a couple of times. Both times I didn't know that he was there. He came to the first New Year's Eve show that I did. It was a show on a street, and I was kind of rolling around drunk and singing. The whole band were off their faces. Mm. And he asked me how it had gone, and I said, oh, it was good. And he went, yeah, I know, I was there. Mm. But then he saw me before he died. It was a paid gig at a club, like a proper band. And he was at that too, and he saw that, and he made this comment, you were like an angel, he said. I can't imagine how he could have seen me in that way, quite frankly.
Seeing you as an angel?
Yes, an angel. All things considered.
Is that a real psychotherapist? Is that, you know, how was that scene done?
Yeah, Darian Leader is one of Britain's leading psychoanalysts. He's a brilliant kind of post-Freudian practitioner, and he writes a lot of books as well. He's also a good friend of ours. And we knew that he would be able to... We thought he'd get on with Nick, that was important, and we knew we could trust him. We could trust him to lead a discussion over 2 days that would... that wouldn't kind of let Nick off the hook in the way that I think journalists often do. Mm. You know, that they have prepped kind of, they've already prepped the questions they're going to ask, and they have such short amount of time that Nick kind of is able to say a lot of the same things. We wanted something that just went further, lasted longer, a sort of endurance test. That scene, 2 days, 10 hours of footage, and we shot it 2 months ahead of everything else. Mm. So we really used that to identify a lot of the themes that we were then going to kind of play out in the rest of the film.
One of those themes is, you know, his current home, Brighton. He talks early on in the film about how you know, the place just kind of sucks him in, and, you know, he's put down roots there and is very much part of it. And there's a very funny quote towards the end of the film where he talks about the weather in Brighton. Listen to this.
The sky in Brighton is unlike anything I've ever seen. Living by the sea, looking out my windows, I feel like I'm part of the weather itself. Sometimes the sky is so blue and the reflection of the sea so dazzling you can't even look at it. And other times, great black thunderheads roll across the ocean, and you feel like you're inside the storm itself. What I fear most is nature. Now that it's sent its weather to exact revenge, we're all in for it now. Soon the weather is going to put on a real show. Funnily enough, the more I write about the weather, the worse it seems to get. And the more interesting it becomes. And the more it molds itself to the narrative I've set for it. You know, I can control the weather with my moods. I just can't control my moods, is all.
Again, a great line from Nick Cave. I can control the weather with my moods. I just can't control my moods, is all. And the music in the background that was done as the soundtrack for the film is by?
Nick Cave and Warren Ellis.
And Warren Ellis is a longtime multi-instrumentalist violinist collaborator who we see a lot of in the course of the film. So one of the main things that I came away from this movie with was the idea of how Nick Cave has moved from being very much a solo artist to a very, very collaborative one. I mean, collaborating with you guys on the film, but, you know, having Kylie Minogue in the back of the car, having Blixa Bargeld appear suddenly in the car from the German band Ein Sturz in den Neubauten, but another longtime collaborator with Nick. These kind of surprising reminders of just how collaborative his art form has become now.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's one of the incredible things about Nick as an artist, really, is that he's managed to have several of those unique relationships that, you know, you think of the classic kind of rock and roll partnerships, and you think of, like, you know, Mick and Keith and all that kind of thing. And they're relationships that either, you know, come and go very quickly and people go their own ways and never quite recapture that kind of magic, or they last a lifetime. And I think for Nick, the idea that he's been able to have that relationship with Blixer, with Mick Harvey, with Roland Howard, now very, very much with Warren Ellis, mm-hmm. it's a pretty unique and remarkable thing.
The creative process very much in play in the film called 20,000 Days on Earth, a collaborative project of Ian Forsyth and Jane Pollard, the two directors who've been here with me in the Soundcheck studio, and featuring the singer-songwriter Nick Cave and various members of his band, past and present. Ian, Jane, thank you both very much for being with us.
Pleasure.
Thank
you.
Nice to meet you.
I was right, and I was right. The sun was rising from the field.
Up next, time to find out how a Gregorian chant-inspired song with lyrics in Latin and French became an international chart-topping sensation. Our series, That Was a Hit, comes back to Soundcheck next.
And now, Soundcheck looks back at the pop charts of yesteryear and asks,
That was a hit?
Everybody was kung fu.
They're coming to take me away, haha.
Time now for another installment of That Was a Hit, Soundcheck's look at puzzling chart success. And today we are joined again by our frequent guest, Chris Melanfi. And today, Chris, we're going to talk about this song that we're hearing beneath us from our regular That Was a Hit opening montage.
That's right, yep. It's Sadness or Sodness. Part one, that part one is an important detail, Sadness Part One by Enigma.
Now, it is spelled S-A-D-E, as in the Marquis de Sade.
That is correct,
so,
yes.
Although in England, I think it was released without the E, so it looked like Sadness.
Yeah, and a lot of people pronounced it Sadness, but I suppose if you're being very specific, you should say Sodness.
So who or what is Enigma?
Okay, Enigma is the musical project. They're not a group per se. The musical project of a Romanian-born, Germany-based gentleman named Michael Cretu, C-R-E-T-U. He has kind of been in and around the German music industry for decades, long before he had this hit. As far back as the 70s, he crossed paths with German music mastermind Frank Farian. If you've ever heard that name, he's behind two mega pop groups, one in the 70s, Boney M, who had a number of international hits, including a couple in the U.S. And then he became quite infamous as the mastermind behind Milli Vanilli in the 90s. Michael Cretu played keyboards a little bit during the Boney M days, and that helped get his start.
All right, so Michael Cretu, Romanian-born, German-based, he comes up with this collision of Gregorian chant and new wave electronics and dance beats, and how big a hit does he end up with?
He ends up with an international number one hit that also made it to number five on the U.S. Billboard Hot 100. This thing just exploded. It was kind of a brainstorm that he had. He became a producer in the late 80s, and one of the acts he produced was this German singer named Sandra, who did a cover of Everlasting Love. We all know this song. We've all heard it, Everlasting Love. And he led that recording off with a very faint Gregorian chant. You can barely hear it. It's in the mix in the first 10 seconds of the song. And it kind of gave him the idea, well, what if I took that idea and went further? What if I did a whole album pairing pre-existing Gregorian chants with sort of dance beats and new agey elements and vaguely mystical themes and, you know, just kind of did a whole album that paired these old sounds with these dance beats? And he had, you know, all of these vaguely gothic titles like Mea Culpa and The Rivers of Belief. And then, of course, the centerpiece was Sadness, which, by the way, was part of the reason he had to call the single Sadness Part One is because on the album, it is part of an 11-minute suite called The Principles of Lust.
Yeah.
And
so in addition to the sampled Gregorian chant, there's a breathy French female voice.
Yep, saying, Sad, dis-moi, sad, donne-moi.
Tell me, give me.
Exactly,
yeah.
in a rather orgasmic voice.
Yeah, so it's a little porny in addition to the mysticism and stuff. It was a global hit back in 1990 for Enigma. It is such a bizarre mashup of like religious prayer, thousand-year-old chant with this very kind of sexy whispery vocals and stuff. Chris Melanfi is a pop chart analyst, contributor to NPR Music and Slate, and our frequent guest on our That Was a Hit series about surprising, even puzzling chart success. And on Soundcheck today, we're finally talking about Sodness, or Sadness, depending on how you want to pronounce it, the 1990 song by Enigma that is part of our regular opening montage when we do That Was a Hit. The flute sound, that's a Japanese shakuhachi flute, also sampled.
Right.
Which he seems not to have gotten in trouble for.
No, that may be one of the few things he did get in trouble
for. But everything else he got in trouble. I mean, you know, he didn't clear the rights for the Gregorian chant.
No.
Lost a lawsuit.
Let's also remember that this is 1990. There hasn't been a ruling on sampling yet, right? The Bismarck Key case in 1991 hasn't happened yet. So it's still the Wild West days of, you know, borrowing whatever you want.
And yet, you know, the German group, the Capella Antiqua, that he sampled,
right,
they eventually came after him and got a settlement.
Understandably. I mean, a global hit like that, my goodness.
Yeah. And there's a little fragment from the Hilliard Ensemble, which they told us here in the studio many years ago. They had to, like, listen really, really closely.
Because it's
like,
just buried in the mix.
It had been pitch shifted. And
sure.
And they went after them, too, and got a settlement. So.
I mean, this guy has had only a couple of hits, but, like, he had to eventually settle with virtually everybody who was involved with any piece of it.
And in so doing, this guy, Michael Cretu, the guy behind Enigma, set off a kind of chain reaction of pop hits.
He did.
For Gregorian chant.
Yeah. I mean, that's the crazy thing. I mean, first of all, what's kind of nuts about Sodness itself is that in addition to being a hit single, it sold a truckload of albums. This album kind of became the Tubular Bells of its day. It sold for years. It was on the Billboard charts here in America for 5 years. I'm not exaggerating.
Wow.
You know, you can gather that people heard the song and thought, gee, I think I want an hour of that. And then, as if all that wasn't enough, it spawned a fad where, in 1994, an unrelated album by a group of 36 monks living in an 8th century monastery in north central Spain who called themselves the Benedictine Monks of Santo Domingo de Silos, they released an album called Chant. It reached number 3 on the Billboard 200 album chart, and it ultimately went double platinum.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this became a phenomenon.
And spawned a kind of renaissance of chant music in the middle of the 1990s, including this. If you were waiting for the drum beats, the synthesizers, the sampled flute, not going to happen. The Benedictine monks of Santo Domingo de Silos in Spain had a couple of hit records with plain old Gregorian chant in the wake of this Enigma song.
Right. It's like people went back and they wanted the uncut stuff.
Multiple millions of these albums sold.
Yes.
So do we look back at Enigma and that song, Sodness, from 1990, and do we say, one-hit wonder, here today, gone tomorrow?
I mean, yes and no. First of all, he's not a one-hit wonder. It wasn't even his biggest or last hit. A couple years later, in 1994, he released a sequel album called Enigma 2, The Cross of Changes. It went double platinum. It spawned a number 4 hit. It actually went a notch higher on the charts, called Return to Innocence. Yet again, he got himself in trouble because he sampled Taiwanese chanting that was taken from a pre-existing recording and sampled without permission. Again, he had to settle afterward. And he still records as Enigma and does pretty well for himself. That Enigma record is a perennial seller. For a time, it was even one of Virgin Records' all-time best-selling albums.
The album was called MCMCX AD.
That's right, which just means in Roman numerals 1990.
1990.
But it looked good and gothic on the cover.
It really did. And that hit, Sodness by Enigma, was everywhere in 1990. Yes, that was a hit. Chris Melanfi, once again, good to have you here.
Anytime, John.
On Monday's show, we kick off our quest to find and compile the funniest songs of all time with comedian Eugene Merman. He adds a couple of not-so-intentionally funny songs to our list. Tell us which songs you think are hilarious, intentionally or otherwise. Call us up at 866-939-1612. Plus, Ryan Adams has a brand new album out, and he has a lot to say about it. Actually, he just has a lot to say in general. We'll talk with the singer-songwriter about his entirely analog studio, 7-Eleven Donuts, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Black Sabbath, and much more. And we may even squeeze in a couple of songs. That's on Monday. Soundcheck is a production of WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team with Paul Schneider, Bill O'Neill, and Jason Isaac. The show is produced by Katie Bishop, Dan O'Donnell, and Mike Katziff, with Amy Pearl, Alex Kappelman, and our interns, Haley Shaw, Cooper Mackey, and Bailey Constance. Our executive producer is Joel Meyer. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday. That does it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.